Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's program.
We want a sustainable program because we want to be in a position to repay the loans that we have accepted. And when we ask to reduce the debt, we are asking for that because we want to be able to pay this back. We don't want to be forced time and time again to accept new loans to pay off the old ones.
As Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras calls for a united Europe, the members of the European Parliament stress the need for a concrete proposal. George Brock and Isabel Hilton will tell us their thoughts on the unfolding Greek crisis. Then we turn our focus to Burma as it announces the date for its first open general election in 25 years. And also ahead...
What is of utmost importance is that we have been transformed from former enemies to become friends, partners, comprehensive partners, and I'm convinced that our relationship will continue to grow in the future.
We discuss the historic meeting between US President Barack Obama and the leader of Vietnam's Communist Party, Nguyen Phu Trong. All that plus a look at China as its stock market keeps stumbling. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are George Brock and Isabel Hilton. George Brock is Professor of Journalism at City University here in London, and Isabel Hilton is the editor of China Dialogue. George and Isabel, welcome to you both. Now, as has become normal, let's begin with Greece. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has been given until Sunday to reach an agreement with his creditors, or Greece's creditors, in order to save the country's collapsing economy. Standing before the members of the European Parliament today, Tsipras urged for a united Europe, stressing he was confident that Greece could meet its obligations in the interests of Greece and the Eurozone in the coming days. And Isabel Hilton, France seems to have, at least on the surface in public, be trying to share Mr. Tsipras's optimism. The Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, says that a deal is within grasp, and France is basically Greece's best ally at the moment.
Well, yes, I guess it's not. There's not much to hope from Germany and France.
No.
Maybe enjoying reasserting a role which everyone had rather forgotten, that it was one of the main drivers of the European Union and one of the main drivers of the euro. After all, the euro was partly, you know, France's grand bargain with Germany back after 1989. Is there anything left to say about Greece? Have we said it all so many times? Do we really believe this is the end? I mean, clearly, great deadlines, you know, fierce deadlines have been given. I still find it quite hard to believe that in the end, Greece will be left to die. Because if Greece, you know, if this does end up in an expulsion from the euro and a collapse, you have already a broken country. You have a serious humanitarian crisis in an EU member state. It's going to rebound on the EU in a major way, and they won't get their money back. So I still think that even though I still remain in the end, I believe something will be done.
And that's the thing, George Brock, isn't it? That it seems that certain European leaders and European people as well seem so angry that they're quite happy for, well, it's Greece's own fault, and if they suffer, so what?
I don't really believe that that is the attitude of the people doing the negotiating and the serious politicians. They may want to give the impression that they're that annoyed. I don't really believe it. Never underestimate the ability of EU politicians to cook fudge, so to speak, to pull something at the very, very last minute, indeed after the last minute. It's never really the 11th hour quite for them. Indeed, they are the people who invented literally stopping the clock to get a deal at the end. So I still think there is some chance of that. But I think what did happen today was that some of those people did start to use very much more serious language. They are prepared to admit, this is quite a big deal in the EU if people actually admit things in the open. An enormous amount of EU negotiation involves not telling people the truth. And they did start to use some very, very much more serious phrases. So they do realize there is a lot at stake. But I think the stuff at stake, makes them very badly want to get a deal and to keep Greece in. Almost all the consequences of Greece coming out are bad. I mean, there are some splits among the hardliners, the German-led group, if you like. Some of them say, no, it'd be really good for the euro if we took Greece out. You know, it'd be stronger, it'd be harder, we could get a better arrangement, it would all be simpler. We're insulated against it. People have discounted this for ages. Don't worry. That's one school of thought. I think it's the minority school of thought.
And then there's the sensible people that say, if that happens, then Spain will be next, and then maybe Italy will be next. And
there's the contagion argument. The other school of thought is, no, it's going to be really embarrassing. It's humiliating. It changes the nature of the single currency, and it will encourage other countries to do the same thing.
One thing, Isabel, that strikes me about how badly Syriza has played its hand over the last 5 or 6 months is that all the emphasis seems to be on Greece to come up with its proposals. The Eurozone minister saying, come on then, Greece, where's your proposal? Oh, they didn't come up with a proposal. This is ridiculous. At no time, you know, has Greece managed to put the onus back on the creditors and say, well, look, the IMF has accepted that we're not going to be able to pay off this debt. So where's your proposal? Where's your proposal to say, right, we're willing to compromise on this and, you know, we'll take a haircut of even 20%?
I think, to be fair to Tsipras, he's tried. And certainly the sentiment seems to be growing around Tsipras that essentially from the moment he came into government, that other EU leaders were looking for essentially regime change, that they did not want to accommodate Tsipras because they feel that accommodating that radical government, challenging what is a very, you know, Germanic status quo view of how the economy should be managed, was too dangerous. Now, you know, you could say that's left-wing paranoia, but it's not entirely, I think. I think if you track what has been said all the way through this crisis, and if you look at the EU's actions and statements, it's not very impressive. And it is undoubtedly true that this insistence on austerity has made matters infinitely worse. And that I think that there's a lack of recognition in the EU over that, even if the IMF has finally come round to it. So Tsipras's, you know, gamesmanship has been, I'm sure, infuriating clearly to the Germans. But I don't think one can entirely blame him for failing to throw the responsibility back on a group of leaders who were determined not to take it.
I think if you want to understand, however, why this seems one way, and I'm certainly not justifying the German attitude to austerity here, but I think if you want to understand, you do have to remember how this deal over the single currency was originally cut. After all, Germany was not really a country, either its people or its political class, that wanted to do the single currency. They did the single currency on the basis that it would be set up a certain way. Have it if it has Deutschmark-like characteristics. And those are kind of their hard rules, if you like.
Fine.
And therefore they have said, look...
Well, no, sorry, on that point,
yep.
who was the first country to break those rules? It was the Germans.
It was the Germans. They went over the 3%, yeah.
On the Stability and Growth Pact.
Yeah.
And also, you know, who were the main banks that lent all this money to Greece at crazily low rates? It was German banks. It's the idea that Germans can say, well, we didn't want anything to do with this and the wool's been completely pulled over our eyes. We had no idea people were going to cheat like this.
No, you can pile other points on top of that. You can say German officials must have been among those who decided that Greece was, you know, a good idea in the single currency in the first place, was obeying the rules when they clearly weren't. The percentages and figures were all different. No, you can pile a lot more on that. I'm just simply saying that when the pressure is on, what the German political class tends to do is to retreat into the position of saying they find it extremely difficult to negotiate about this because any sign of flexibility is to them they are liable to be accused of destroying the original compact, the basis. I mean, they're clearly going to have to do that to get out of this situation. I'm not arguing against that.
I think they are going to have to do that. And I think also they're going to have to lay aside the moral question of paying debts, because as has been pointed out repeatedly in the last week, you know, Germany's debts were forgiven. And that was the basis of the stability of post-war Germany.
Well, they were forgiven in 1953.
Yes.
But they weren't forgiven after the First World War, and we all know where that ended.
Well, indeed. And Germany ought to remember that too. So they were forgiven. I mean, and in as you say, in 1953, the Deutschmark erased the currency trauma of the 1930s. And of course, it became a kind of totemic item in Germany. But it's gone too far in terms of the moral insistence. And I think it really is time to back off at this point.
Just finally, and I'm interested in both your views on this. George, when we look at the referendum and the debate that took place in Greece over those 8 days, there was obviously a discussion about economics. It was, you know, economics was a huge part of what was going on. But there was also a very strong emotional argument about nationalism and national pride and dignity. When we look at that referendum, also what happened in Scotland last year, and then we also sort of look ahead to what might happen with the EU referendum coming any time in the next 18 to 24 months here in the UK. Do you think that actually that issue of national pride and this idea of dignity and standing up to, you know, these faceless people in Europe who don't have our best interests at heart, can you see through the Tsipras victory last week a way that the better off outers could win here?
Do I think that nationalism tends to crop up when people have been telling us that it is either pointless or is dead? Yes, there's lots of evidence that that happens all the time. And it's been, you know, it's been going on. Whether or not Greece will be able to turn that into something different, I think depends on, very much depends on the outcome of the negotiations we've just been talking about. I mean, just to really underline the paradox, if they really wanted to do that, if they really wanted to win economically, you can perfectly easily argue they'd be better off outside the euro, not inside it. They're going to have a very tough time inside. I mean, don't let's think that if there's a fudge or a deal, Greece is going to have an easy time. Greece is going to have a hard time either way.
But Isabel, in terms of, you know, we're not just seeing this in the UK, but in France with Front National and elsewhere, this idea of national identity and national dignity and standing up to the outsiders from Europe, does that view worry you looking forward?
Yes, I think it does if it was only that. But I think there are a lot of things going on in these referenda. And I think that there's a lot of undischarged emotion from the global financial crisis, which was certainly true in the Scottish referendum, the sense of ordinary people being trapped inside a system that does not serve them, that serves people they can't get at, the people who caused the crisis and got away with it. And I think there was quite a lot of that, I think, in Greece. And actually, there's a fair bit of that, even in UKIP, although it's expressed as anti-European Union. It is the sense of the little people who are not getting a fair shout. Now, that can go in lots of different directions. It can go constructively, or it can go extremely unpleasantly. But yes, the stronger those emotions are, and the less legitimate outlet there is, the less response they get, the more likely they are to be unpleasant.
It's a loss of identity and control in general, isn't it? In a very broad sense. And you clearly saw that in Greece, and I think to some extent, as Isabel said, you saw it in Scotland. We may see it in the Euro referendum. It a lot depends on the climate of the campaign and when it occurs and in what circumstances.
Okay, let's move on now to Burma, where the date has just been set for its general election. 8th of November will be the day, and it will be the first open general election, hopefully, in 25 years. However, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi is constitutionally barred from taking the post of president, leaving questions of who might take her place from her party, the National League for Democracy. Isabel Hilton, Aung San Suu Kyi obviously won the last proper free and fair elections that Burma held a generation ago. She's barred from running this time, But do you detect any sense that this election might actually be the free and fair election that the Burmese junta have promised?
I think it's going to get pretty close. They've accepted international observers. They have... I think it's too late to go back at this point. You know, the alternative, if this was not a credible election, they're going to face opposition on the streets, they're going to face scrutiny, they're going to lose, you know, whatever they might still be able to retain in terms of power. They're operating on a constitution that's essentially rigged in their favour, 20% of the parliament reserved for them. They have managed to maintain a lot of the structures of privilege within the economy through this transition. And I think that at this point, it would be pretty catastrophic for the military as well as for, you know, the rest of Burmese society, if this were to go wrong. So that although I think that Aung San Suu Kyi's NLD is going to do pretty well in this election, as you say, she can't, under the present constitution, be the president. Whether she will do well enough that another proposal to change the constitution could be put before a new parliament is an open and interesting question. And she certainly seems to keep that idea dangling. When asked about it, she says, I'm sure this will change, but I can't say when, which I think probably reflects the hope that if the NLD really gets into power, and they're likely to do, as I say, very well, then at that point they're back in the game, and perhaps they can eventually see her leading the country.
George, the military rule as well, who certainly technically don't necessarily rule anymore, but certainly still have enormous power in Burma, as Burma has opened up, have certainly done pretty well at keeping things under their control. As Isabel mentioned, they have 25% of the seats in parliament, and if you want to change the constitution, you need 75% plus one. So nothing's really going to change unless they want to. Do you think that the West has been duped a little bit into believing that Burma has become more open and more democratic than it actually has?
No, quite the opposite. I think the West is, I mean, those people who study it seem to me to be perfectly clear-eyed about what's going on. I mean, it's a perfect example, I think, so far, fingers crossed, of the way in which illogical and infuriating gradualism actually works. It's not logical what they do constitutionally. It's not right, technically, strictly. And it's infuriating that it goes so slowly if you sit from outside, from an American or European constitutional perspective. But these things can very easily go dreadfully wrong and tip into violence and worse. This is a very large, ethnically very complex country. And I think so far they have managed miraculously well. May they continue to do it gradually, because it seems to work.
Do you share that optimism as well?
I certainly share that judgment. And I think that such transitions are messy and, as you say, in some ways infuriating. But it is still moving slowly and in a crabwise, perhaps, in the right direction. And I think it is quite unrealistic to expect, you know, magic sunshine and bluebirds the day after, you know, this kind of transition. There's also, I think, on all sides, an interest in peace and stability. So you actually do need the military to some extent, you know, inside the tent. We have negotiated a lot of ceasefires since this transition began, but there is no comprehensive national peace agreement. There is a continuing dreadful problem with the Rohingya, and uncertain truces in Kachin and so on. So it's fragile, and I think that on all sides there is a willingness to inch forward, as long as people feel confident that they're not going to go backwards.
And also, George Brock, it's worth pointing out that Burma's rulers are wary of being of having to rely too much on China, as they have in the past.
I think that's probably right. I think they have, like almost every neighbour of that vast country, a rather wary and ambivalent relationship, and they want to be able to play the field. Let's hope that if there is a new government after the election, we don't know that yet, but if there is a new government, that they will think about things the same way and decide not to be too dependent on China.
Okay, we're going to stay in that region in the second part of Midori House. Do stay tuned.
As Monocle's editors and correspondents dart from city to city, they get to know the best places to rest their heads, stretch their limbs after a long flight, and kick back with a contact in a hard-to-find cocktail bar. All this information is now available in a new collection of books, Monocle's Travel Guide series published by Gestalten. Up first, London.
This place won't ever beg for your adoration. It's just not that kind of town. But if you stick around long enough and occasionally give it your undivided attention, the city will eventually reveal what all the fuss is about. Trust us, it's worth the wait.
To celebrate the publication of our London guide, Monocle Films has produced a cinematic portrait of the city, from wild parks and lofty gardens to culinary discoveries and the best music venues. Our film journeys to our favourite places in the city we call home. London, premiering now in the film section at monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, George Brock and Isabel Hilton. China's stock market is collapsing once more. The value of its shares keeps dropping. More than 1,300 companies have announced they will be suspending trading. That's almost half of China's main shares. Analysts have admitted that there is genuine panic selling underway. Isabel Hilton, how worried should China be?
Oh, China should be worried. It's not that the stock market is a huge part of the Chinese economy. It's relatively small. But China should be worried for a number of reasons. That part of the vulnerability of the stock market is to do with leveraged, it's to do with margin trading. It's to do with buying and selling shares on borrowed money. The government engineered this bubble about a year ago by writing in the state media that there was going to be a terrific bull run. There are a lot of people with nowhere to put their money since the property market collapsed and banks don't show any return. So one of the characteristics of the Chinese stock market is that it's dominated by small traders, and the government relaxed the rules on opening accounts, so another 20 million accounts were opened. You have a lot of small people who've really bet the farm, believing that the government was going to back their investment because it had encouraged them to pile in. Now, some of them will be okay because, you know, if you look year on year, they're still ahead. But those who came in the last 6 months really could have lost quite a lot. That's a lot of very upset middle-class people. But you may also have a knock-on effect, because one of the characteristics of the Chinese economy at present is that it is absolutely riddled with debt. We've been talking about Greece. If you add Chinese corporate and private debt and local government debt together, you get to well over 200% of GDP. This is very fragile, given that property prices have collapsed. So you're looking at potentially a subprime problem, which people up to now have pretty much dismissed because of the strengths of the Chinese government treasury. But it's not looking so great anymore.
And that, George Brock, that's a problem not just for China, but considering the fact that China is the world's second largest economy, that could be a problem for many other parts of the world too.
Well, it could be. I mean, there are obviously, I mean, it is because it is that size of economy, almost anything that goes bad will have impacts outside. They could possibly, you know, they might buy less. Chinese consumers will buy less for people who are trying to, and they will trade less in general. But I think it is more likely to be, if we're comparing it, a bigger problem in China. I mean, what I'm interested in is whether it turns into a political problem. I mean, I've seen one estimate that says that, you know, this $3 trillion loss in value affects about 90 million people. Now, they're not all the people who, as Isabel put it, came in the last 6 months, but that's quite a lot of people, not necessarily to impoverish, but to disillusion and annoy. We don't yet know what the impact of these things is. And in those kinds of societies, you don't always get immediate impacts either. It's not necessarily crash, burn. It's crash, silence, and then wait to see what happens in the medium term.
And Isabel, when we look at, you know, those countries affected by financial crises over the past few years, pretty much every government fell. Now, obviously, Were that to happen in China, that would be a very, very different story. But there was that outlet for voters to, you know, show their anger, say they want to take a different course, which isn't available in China.
This, as you say, is a political system with Chinese characteristics. It's also worth noting that for the last 2 years, Xi Jinping has been consolidating internal security arrangements in his own hands. And even, you know, for the last 5 years, China has spent much more on internal security than on external defence. So clearly there is a nervousness in the regime itself. My own feeling, and I could be entirely wrong about this, it's very hard to predict in China, but my own feeling is that if there is a threat to the regime, it will come from inside rather than from the streets. I think it is, and if it does come from the streets, it would be pretty terrible. But I think it's very hard to imagine an Arab Spring being played out in Beijing, but I could imagine eventually tensions within the regime coming to the point where some sort of bloodletting had to happen to restore credibility of the government. One thing that's been lost this week is the sense that the government is infallible, wise, far-seeing. You know, in fact, foreigners had signed up to this rather bizarre position. As much as Chinese did, you know, say what you like about the Chinese Communist Party, they know what they're doing with the economy. As though, you know, the last 30 years of boom really equipped you to do the very tricky avoiding the middle income trap kind of transition that they're undertaking now. And I think that sense of, you know, you see them in the headlights and the stock market keeps falling, that's damaging.
Okay, now finally, Vietnam's General Secretary Nguyen Phu Trinh is taking part in a historic state visit to Washington, D.C. He's met with President Barack Obama a little earlier. They discussed trade, climate change and plans to cooperate in defence issues. George Brock, this would have been hard to imagine a generation ago, wouldn't it?
It would. They'd fought this long, ghastly catastrophic in Vietnam itself, extremely divisive in America war, which kind of marked the politics and culture of an entire generation. So it's not very surprising that it's taken an extremely long time to recover. And I've only made one visit to Vietnam, but it wasn't that long ago. And I was very struck by how even now, decades after the end of the war, even if you don't speak Vietnamese, it is quite obvious you are in a society which is still in a state of recuperation. It there is an atmosphere of kind of still of repair, and you know there is a certain cast of certain cast over it that the past makes. So good for them for meeting. And I'm looking at a quite extraordinary table here. Somebody polled across the world and said, "Are people better off in a free market economy?" Okay. So in the United States, they got 70%.
Uh-huh.
In Vietnam, they got 95%.
Wow. Vietnam led by a communist party. Isabel Hilton, Barack Obama appears to be trying to, you know, create a more positive foreign policy legacy in his final 2 years. Obviously, you know, in the past few months, most notably has been the rapprochement with Cuba. Now he's invited, you know, the Vietnamese General Secretary to Washington, D.C. It's quite possible there'll be a return trip. You can see that being his final sort of big trip there. Do you think that's what he's looking at here?
Well, I think he's looking at a number of things here. and I think that they tend to come back to China. You know, we remember the U.S. Vietnamese war, but shortly after that ended, there was another war that we tend to forget, which was the so-called self-defensive counterattack when the Vietnamese and Chinese fought a very short but very, very bloody war in the late 70s, and the Vietnamese won. And so, you know, the Vietnamese turn to the United States as a triumph of geography over history, if you like. They fought the Americans for 20 years, but they fought China for 2,000-3,000 years. And that is their concern now. And it chimes very closely with Barack Obama's growing concern about the U.S. position in Asia. He's on the back foot because of AIIB. He's, you know, the Chinese have been very assertive.
But they're in, the Chinese new international bank.
In Asian investment, infrastructure investment bank, which only the Japanese and the US are out of. So he's pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And Vietnam could emerge as a key ally of the United States in this.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Isabel Hilton and George Brock, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on Midori House. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Henry Reese Sheridan, Caroline Hamelgren and Elena Nikolajeva. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Ben Ryland is here next. Then it's Danny Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs. Andrew Muller will be your host at Midori House, same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.